The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm John Heilman.
And I'm Will Leach.
And this is the Culture Caucus, Bloomberg Politics' podcast dedicated to the intersection of politics and culture. Culture broadly defined, meaning pretty much everything that doesn't happen in Washington, D.C. We are in the home stretch of at least this incarnation of the podcast, just as we are in the home stretch of the presidential race. It is, as of this recording, it's Thursday, November the 3rd, 4th?
Yes.
What date is it, Will?
It is the 3rd.
It's the 3rd, November 3rd, so just 5 days now until Election Day, and we are going to have a very special episode here, special because of the guest who we have on. We've done pretty well booking guests on the show, I think. Some of them have been very interesting, some have been glamorous, but the combination of interesting, glamorous, and pertinent in a very particular way to the to the context and contours and the particular dynamics of this presidential race is our guest today, who is the one and only and none other than George Lopez, who I think it's fair to say is maybe the most popular Hispanic entertainer in the country. Is that fair, Will?
Yeah, and I would argue has been for a decade now, I think.
Yeah, right.
One of the things that's most impressive is not just his popularity, but his longevity.
Yeah, I mean, he's an amazing, amazing guy. And the story of how George came to be here intersects with a story that all right-thinking people are interested in at this moment, particularly on this day and this date, which is baseball. I ran into George Lopez at the Dodgers-Cubs Game 2 of the NLCS. We happened to be sitting next to each other in Wrigley Field, and we got to talking, and I asked him, as maybe the most popular and well-known Hispanic entertainer in the country, whether he'd been asked a lot about Donald Trump over the course of 2016. And he said, no, not really. Very few people had talked to him about it, and he said he had very strong opinions, and he'd thought about it a lot. And I said, well, you should come on the Culture Caucus and talk about those. And he said, great. So that was a couple weeks ago, and now we're here, and we're going to have him on. And as a way of kind of bringing this, having an episode that brings us right up to Election Day, I think it's a kind of a good thing to discuss. A good guest to have on and a good set of discussions to have, because, of course, one of the lasting legacies of this campaign will be the way in which Donald Trump alienated, I would say, a large swath of non-white voters. And if he doesn't end up winning on Tuesday, that will be a large part of why. And so discussing that with someone who is, in fact, a non-white voter, I think, and someone who is very in touch with his community is a kind of an interesting way to close, or at least not to close the podcast, but to dedicate ourselves, to occupy ourselves with in this home stretch. So, Will, you have some questions for George.
Oh, yes, of course. Of course. I'm very excited to talk to him, and not just about the national nightmare that is the Chicago Cubs.
Yes. You know, so that is a thing. You know, one of the great things about Will Leach is he always has good questions. Will, you're always a man filled with questions, boundless energy, lots of curiosity beyond measure.
Yes.
You're also, as everyone knows, whoever has ever listened to this podcast before, you're also a huge baseball fan. And so I need for you at this moment, even though it has nothing to do with the topic at hand, I need for you to just tell us a little bit about the experience of being in Cleveland last night for Game 7.
Yeah, it was something. It is, I will say, I was not at the 2011 Game 6 of the World Series, which is the best baseball game I've ever seen on television, but this was the best baseball game I've ever seen in person. And I wrote a column about it for Sports on Earth, where I write about a lot of sports stuff. And to me, one of the things was amazing. You know, I grew up in Central Illinois. I'm a Cardinals fan, but, you know, I grew up with the University of Illinois. I'm surrounded by Cubs fans. We grew up with Cubs fans. And one of the things I found really amazing about the experience of being there was, like, in about the sixth inning, when the Cubs were up 5-1, and it really looked like they were going to do it. Even my most fatalistic Cub fan friends were texting me, this shit's going to happen now. This is the year. It's finally happening. They're throwing all caution to the wind and saying, this is the year. We all knew it. Finally, I can't believe it. They're counting outs. And I wonder at the time, is this how this should happen? Should the Cubs breeze through, really. And like, shouldn't they have to come back for 3-1 deficit? But should there be no major drama as they win game seven? I wonder if that was the right way to do it. Like, why they've suffered enough? Why get their hearts pumping again? So when Rajai Davis, who hit that home run off our oldest Chapman to tie the game in the eighth inning for Cleveland, when he hit that homer, I was sitting next to Phil Rogers, who's a former reporter for the Chicago Tribune and now works for MajorLeagueBaseball.com. I had met him roughly an hour and a half earlier, mostly with a head nod. I tackled him and did things with him that may be illegal in many states and are certainly dangerous and not to be done without adult supervision. It was a very exciting thing. It was really an amazing thing to be a part of. So then for the Cubs to come back and do it, as I kind of argued in my piece, it really was perfect because there was that one last moment where for that inning after the Indians came back, it felt like, oh my God, maybe the curse is actually real. Is this the worst possible thing a Cubs fan could go through? Would be to get this close, to get within four outs and then blow. We were that close to that happening, and all of this perfect year for the Cubs and all of these wonderful things has happened to them, and had this dominant season and this team we focused on from the very beginning and the one that's captured all of America's imagination. If they would get four outs away and then blow it, would be the most Cubs thing ever. And I argue that was kind of why it was perfect for them to be reminded one last time of what the last 108 years were like right before you were able to extinguish it. It was a pretty amazing thing to be there for, even if I was, in fact, a sad Cardinals fan.
Yeah, you know, I'll say, I mean, it was an incredible game to watch on television. I saw part of it. I was out in Salt Lake City, Utah yesterday, and I saw part of it on my phone and part of it at a bar at the airport and part of it on the plane. And people were obviously everywhere you went, that there were screens anywhere. People were fixated and watching the game. There was cheering and yelling and howling throughout Salt Lake City Airport, throughout the most dramatic parts there in the eighth inning. And it kind of made me think about one of the things that people have been saying over the course of these last days as the series has played out, which is, you know, that this was an incredible series. A bit, you know, whether you were a Cubs fan or an Indians fan or not, people felt good about those two teams being in the World Series. You know, that they're two long-suffering cities, long-suffering teams, having them face off with each other. And then the series to play out in the way in which it did, going seven games, just in and of itself kind of a great thing, doesn't always happen. And then, you know, for it to end with this incredible thing where both teams left everything on the field, a game both teams played with a lot of heart, and you ended up with a conclusion that, frankly, had either one of them won, it would have been crushing, obviously, for the Cubs if they lost. But unless you were a Cubs fan or an Indians fan, you kind of didn't care how it ended. It had been a great series no matter what. And for a lot of people that I've heard over the course of this last week, as they have really hit the breaking point on the presidential campaign and felt like, you know, I've been swimming through, the national conversation has been one that's been like taking a bath in a river of toxic sludge now for weeks upon end. People really, I thought, really relished the diversion of the World Series to a possibly greater degree than I've ever seen before. You hear people saying, you know, can we make this World Series please go on for another week? just so it could be the other thing going on in parallel all the way through to Election Day, so I would have something else that was engrossing and captivating and exciting and fun to focus on, so I could turn away from, you know, the horror that the presidential election has become. I don't know. Did you have that sense from, I mean, I know you were more in the middle of it, right? You were in Cleveland, then you were in Chicago, then you were in Cleveland. But I can't imagine that there wasn't some sense of that in those two great American cities too.
Oh yeah, there's no question. You know, of course, like all reporters covering any event in person, I was of course also covering it by Twitter, as most reporters covered anything anymore. And so certainly I was very aware of that conversation. It was really kind of an amazing thing. There was a great joke going on around Twitter on game night that, wait, is this going to be a test case? Is this a test run for Tuesday? Like all the crazy emotions and everybody up and down one way. And I certainly hope not, because if it's as intense and close as that game was, but you add, of course, politics and all the emotion and anger and frustration to go with that, I'm not sure we'll survive the evening. So I do think that you do feel bad for Cleveland in one way, and if Cleveland were playing any team other than the Cubs in any other context, the city of Cleveland had not just won a championship three months earlier, the big story would be Cleveland. It's all, they haven't won a champion. They are now the team in Major League Baseball that's gone the longest without winning a championship, and outside the Arizona Cardinals, the longest team in all of the four major professional sports never won a championship. In any other year, they would be the underdog story. But of course, it was their just bad luck to be playing the Cubs. So yeah, but I do think that it was, you know, one of the things I found fascinating though, in the recent years of covering sports, you know, when I started Deadspin in 2005, and one of the fun parts about Deadspin was I was very conscious about like saying, listen, politics are a part of sports, and they are part of, because they're a part of the planet. They're a part of everything that we do in the world. So you can never entirely separate them. However, I did want this to be a place where like you could, like the politics gets ugly and it gets dangerous and it gets nasty and people get mean to one another. And some sports, I think, for a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum, is a way to take a step back from that and a way to get away from it for a little bit. You can't ever truly get away from it, but I understand why people would want to. So, and I find that in the last few years, sports is becoming, it's a lot harder to do that for people. I think that it's harder to find those things. The thing I love about sports is if my team wins, I am happy, and if my team loses, I am sad. And there's beauty in the simplicity of that. And nothing is actually like that in the world, particularly not in politics. So I think that the Cubs were one of those stories where people tried to bring in the fact that the Ricketts are big. First were anti-Trump people, and now are big Trump people, the owners of the Cubs, and they tried to bring in, you know, I think certainly the Indians logo and mascot is something that I think Major League Baseball is going to want to do something about. There are political aspects to this, but it does feel like in that moment, no one's talking about politics. No one's talking about mascots. No one's talking about the owners. No one's talking about the election. They're talking about this amazing thing that's happened that has a zero sum ending to it. And that's kind of the beauty of sports. And I think why people really kind of gravitated toward, the ratings have been unbelievable for this World Series. I think it's one of the reasons that they've really gravitated toward it. It's been an escape from the rather dreary daily, hourly, minute news cycle.
Yeah, and you know, and I think, as I said it before, I think it's, you know, there's the dreariness, but there's also kind of the kind of terror, the terribleness of it. And you know, like I say, we're kind of coming, you know, when you think about, you know, we're kind of coming to, you know, the end of this election. And, you know, we spent a lot of time on the last podcast talking about, you know, relatively straightforwardly talking about the presidential election. You know, one of the things that I, you know, we're now starting to kind of look forward to, you know, what will happen after the election. And, you know, there's only, I think, really one for a lot of people, there are a lot of people out there, obviously, who don't like Donald Trump, and he's provoked, obviously, very intense reactions that are very negative. And, you know, he's done, when I say he's provoked it, I mean, he's provoked it. I mean, he's, right. You know, done things to offend.
Right.
I mean, and just not, it's not like, and also you're not being, it's not like just because people are like, you know, misinterpreting him or being overly sensitive. It's like he's gone out of his way in a lot of ways to offend large swaths of the American electorate. And you know, George Lopez is going to be on and be here in just a minute, is someone who represents one of those swaths of the electorate who Trump has kind of serially offended. And so, you know, for a lot of people right now in this very intense moment, you know, and people are very intensely, you know, there's been a sense of this campaign as being more intense than any campaign previously, more intense than any I've covered before, where both sides feel like the stakes are extraordinarily high. You know, Democrats who think that if Trump becomes president, it will be the apocalypse, and Republicans who think the same if Hillary Clinton becomes president. As we've gotten closer and closer, you know, there's only one respect, it seems to me, for a lot of people who really are terrified by the prospect of Trump winning, in which they will be a little bit sad if he loses, and it pales by comparison to how sad they would be if he won. But the one way in which it was sad is that he will no longer be provide so much comic fodder. You know, Trump as president would be a lot better target for people like George Lopez and for comedians like Alec Baldwin, who we talked about previously. You know, that's the only way in which you can imagine there are a fair number of people who will be looking up and saying, man, I'm really glad that Trump's not president, but I really would have enjoyed kicking the shit out of him on television for the next 4 years.
Yeah, well, until you are arrested for it, of course. But
right.
yes.
And thrown in the stockade, right? Drawn, yes. Quartered, deported, put in a black site someplace. Yeah, all those things.
Yeah, one of the, I mean, to me, just the notion, just to get on the Trump a little bit, one of the notions that's really amazing to me about Trump throughout this campaign is how, you know, Louis C.K. kind of talked about this, and he endorsed Hillary Clinton in kind of an awkward, strange way, I thought, on Conan O'Brien's show. But he talked about how one of the things he really had a hard time with Trump was this notion that Trump has such a hard time handling slights. And anytime he's offended, he just can't let it go and he must push back, regardless of whoever the one that going after him is. And we've seen that in some pretty harrowing ways, frankly, in this campaign. But one of the things that Louis C.K. pointed out was that, like, part of the job of being president of the United States is taking all of that and being that target and letting people come after you, and knowing that by being in the arena, like, you are people, remember the old thanks Obama idea, that no matter what was wrong with someone's lives, oh, thanks Obama, it's your fault, whether it was joking or not. There's something kind of inherently in the national character to, our presidents are never going to be too popular. We're always going to find some way to deride them or have some fun with them or play around with them. And so it would, to me, of the many unprecedented things that a President Trump would bring, certainly in the entertainment realm, the idea of the thin-skinned president who reacts to every slight. Like, imagine the president of the United States. Imagine the tweets that Donald Trump sent out after seeing Alec Baldwin on SNL. Imagine him sending them out as president. Like, all of a sudden, it's an edict. Like, it's an edict. Like, it's an actual decree. And there's something kind of about that still blows my mind to think about that just the idea of what satire is. It would almost, if anything, it would almost weaponize, to use one of the buzzwords of the campaign this year, almost weaponize satire, in that it would actually, like, now it's very easy for me to write a satirical little bonbon about, oh, here's what a Trump presidential would be like, ha, 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 look at me, I will impress all my little blogger, nerdy Ivy League friends. But it would be another thing to make it an actual, almost an act of protest to do satire, which is kind of what it would feel in a Trump administration. I think is a thing that we, I think because of the type of people that write a lot of satire and are into kind of political comedy, they still, even this close to the campaign, and even I think 538 has Trump as a 33% chance, which is a really big chance. That's like the odds of Wade Boggs getting a hit. Like, that's a really good chance of him becoming president. And they still haven't wrapped their mind around the possibility and the reality of it. And I think it's something to really kind of a fascinating idea, the idea of how do you satirize a president that could come after you with the power of the executive branch and the U.S. government for mocking him, and has shown that he would be very eager to do so.
Right. Yes. And I think also it's there's that, right? That's a very kind of pointillist notion of it, right? If I attack this person, he might, in some way, there might be retribution exacted upon me, right? But I think, again, it's one of the things that I have found fascinating about this campaign, and one of the things that, again, I want to talk to George about is, like, this notion that, you know, how do you deal with it if you're the member of a community that feels like not merely that the person who is potentially the president of the United States, not merely that person doesn't represent your interests well, or not merely that person is hostile to your interests, but that person is overtly hostile to your interests, and is not only that, but is kind of is explicitly campaigning on the notion of taking the country backwards to a world in which the progress that has so benefited you and your community no longer exists. Like, someone who's basically kind of saying, you know, the premise of what they're arguing as a political matter is that the world that has evolved in a way that has been, although still difficult, has been overwhelmingly kind of in the direction of making your life better. If you are a Hispanic American, for instance, or an African American, you still have a lot of problems and a lot of challenges, but your life is, as a community, your life is better than it was in the 1950s or in the 1920s or in the 1800s, right? And even just in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been, you know, marked progress. And again, not perfect, not at all have we solved all the problems, but the notion of an increasingly multicultural America and increasingly tolerant America, those are all things that by and large are kind of marks of gradual incremental movement towards the better for you. And to have someone who not only kind of is thin-skinned when attacked or criticized or satirized or parodied, but someone who has essentially built as the premise of his campaign the notion that all of that progress was a mistake, and that you want to somehow basically say, let's go back to an America where all of these groups that have made all these advances are once again marginalized, and not just implicitly marginalized, but explicitly marginalized. I'm going to start my campaign by talking about Mexicans and rapists, and then move on throughout the rest of the campaign by overtly, again, kind of criticizing, you know, Judge Curiel and saying that, you know, because he was Mexican, which of course he wasn't, but because he was Mexican, he couldn't do his job as a judge. You know, textbook definition of racism. How, the way in which comedy works well is where you're able to be often vicious and satirize someone, but not, you're doing it from a posture of, this person poses an existential threat to me. So there's just a bunch of interesting things to try to unpack there, it seems to me. And it would have been, it's a fascinating thought experiment to think about what the culture would do with a President Trump. Not with the idea of a Trump presidency, not with candidate Trump, but with President Trump. What would the culture do with that? What would it make of him? Would that be, I imagine it would produce some kind of incredible art, but it would also be a very kind of precarious situation, I think, in American life.
Yeah, and also, frankly, you couldn't get away with the Jimmy Fallon bullshit anymore. It's probably the best way to put that. You really would not be able to get away with that. You know, the idea that, like, we're all just having fun here. There's no edge to my comedy. It's just funny. Like, comedy is the great comedians will tell you, comedy is about tension. Comedy is about taking something that people care about, or something that is important, or something that is sanctified, or something that is an institution, and trying to knock it down. And it does feel, and I think the culture has kind of gone this way a little bit too. The idea of, well, a large part of comedy too is not trying to push the apple cart too much. You really, those have been the successful guys. That's what Letterman kind of talked about that toward the end of his career. The idea that he never really considered himself edgy, but the idea that, you know, people don't want to be pressed in interviews, and they there's a certain sort of level of comedy that people did not direction they didn't want to go. That's why Jay Leno constantly beat him in the ratings. You wonder if under a Trump presidency, the idea of that kind of empty all four segments comedy, like, there will be no all four segments of anything anymore. It's hard to imagine that in anything in a Trump world not being somewhat divisive in some way, if just because he'll comment on it all himself. So, you know, I think that what it would do to comedy, it would it would certainly, we would have the funniest. Leavenworth would be hilarious.
Yeah.
Rikers would be the best place in the world to see comedy, because you wonder which direction that would go to.
Right. Of course, on the other hand, you know, if the most likely outcome happens and Hillary Clinton becomes president, I mean, it won't be as bad for comedy as Barack Obama being president, because, you know, as we all remember, you think back to 8 years ago and all the comedians were like, oh, my God, like, we're going to have to, like, Barack Obama, that's going to be a hard guy. There's not a lot of material to work with there. You know, he's a relatively as a personality, he's a relatively bland figure, right? How are we going to make fun of this guy? They eventually found ways to make fun of him, but not in the ways that, you know, George W. Bush, for instance, was a so much riper and so much more fun of a target for the culture to mock. You know, now you got Hillary Clinton, and just as a target, you know, she's not nearly as much fun as Trump would be. But on the other hand, you also will now have Bill Clinton. So, you know, there's a compensating virtue, I guess, in terms of the world of comedy. You kind of think, well, you know, Hillary's not that much fun to make fun of, but we got the big dog in the White House. So there's some opportunities there.
Yeah. And I think another thing that people struggle with Obama is kind of in on the joke. Like, he's not necessarily funny. I think he can be funny, and he's shown that he can be funny, but he's also kind of in on the joke. Like, he's it's always amazing to me anytime he'll come on the new show. He was on Samantha Bee last week, and he just instantly seemed to fit in on Samantha Bee's show in a way that Hillary Clinton never fits in anywhere on any of these shows. Even when she does well, she still feels like this foreign figure that's come in on the show, whereas Obama seems to always kind of understand the basic kind of tenets of comedy in that way. And to me, that's been the real struggle to get Obama. It's not that, like, he's not easily mocked. It's just that he rolls with it so well. He doesn't, like, there's a level where obviously he's the president of the United States. He takes himself seriously, but he certainly is aware of how to come across as not taking himself too seriously. Whatever your thoughts about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, one element they both share is taking themselves very seriously not being in on the joke. So I think that will be an advantage for comedians with whoever wins, because they're very easily mocked people. I mean, I actually think Kate McKinnon does a pretty terrific job at getting the intelligence of Hillary and the drive of Hillary, but also the little part of Hillary that's just not that that's just not really, doesn't feel human. It's probably the best way to put it. And she gets that across very well. And while still having that humanity peek out, and then Kate McKinnon's Hillary tried to stamp it down. Like, I feel like that is actually a very clever way to go at her. But Hillary Clinton is always going to do some awkward, strange things on camera, and they'll be easily mocked because of that.
All right. I'm John Heilman, and you're?
I think I'm still Will Leach.
Awesome. That's great. Good to know. I just want to make sure that you were still Will Leach and you hadn't been, like, snatched by a body snatcher and replaced by someone who sounded a lot like Will Leach, but was just, like, better in some way. You know, like
Post Cubs. Who knows who I am anymore? Right. Post Cubs World Series. I could be anyone.
Now, Will, just to remind people right before we take the break, this is the Culture Caucus, and you can find it where and what are you supposed to do when you do find it or when you listen to us on this podcast? What are you supposed to watch as an audience member, as a listener? What are your responsibilities?
Your responsibility, your solemn vow, listener, is after you are done listening to this in your ears and listening to us talk to George Lopez, you should go, if you have not done so already, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And while you're there, please leave us a review on iTunes. It makes it much easier for other people to find us. You can also find us on SoundCloud and, of course, at BloombergPolitics.com.
All right, let's take a little break and come back with George. Hold on. We'll be right back. Great George Lopez is here with me in the studio. George, great to see you.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you, bro.
I just want to ask you before we talk about politics, to the extent that we're going to talk about politics, I just want to talk about, like, how you got into comedy. You know, you are, as I've said to you now three or four times, really probably one of the most famous and well-known Hispanic entertainers in the country. You know, there were guys like Freddie Prinze. There was guys like Desi Arnaz, people like that who are forerunners. But just as a Hispanic growing up in L.A., you got into comedy. You started to think about comedy as a possibility. How?
You know, it's interesting when you think back and it applies to you. Like, you don't ever think you're going to become successful. You don't know at what level you don't have any money. You go to a place where you're not good. You keep going back. You keep going back for years. You see some slight improvement. I mean, there's no guarantee. You're not making any money. It's like, who thinks that as an occupation and say, I can spend the next 10 years trying to get better at something where there's no money and no security. So it's, when I look back and think, you know, it's it all started with a guy that went to Kennedy High School in the San Fernando Valley, and he was doing stand-up at the Comedy Store on Monday nights. My buddy said, hey, this guy Don Nielsen is doing stand-up at the Comedy Store on Monday nights. It's open mic night. You ought to go. And I went June 4th, 79. I was still in high school. And I don't know what happened to Don Nielsen, but George Lopez didn't turn out too bad.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, I mentioned those two guys. Were there when you thought about, like, role models, did you think specifically in terms of Hispanic role models, or did you think about other? Was it just you didn't care? It was just who you thought was funny.
No, you know, it's interesting because, you know, through Cheech and Chong, of course, you know, and through you know, Richard Pryor, Freddie Prinze, George Carlin, Cosby. Then, you know, through Chris Rock and Eddie Murphy, and then now, you know, 55 years old, I've met all of those guys, became friends with those guys, friends with the guys who were on the posters in my wall growing up, musician wise. It's been pretty interesting. You know, it is beyond my own imagination. So, you know, America being the place where you can dream. Even though probably my harshest critics were the ones that were living with me in the house, my grandmother and grandfather, and they both, my grandmother got to see some success, my grandfather did not, but even they couldn't believe, like my grandmother couldn't believe that all of that was happening to me from you leaving the house. She just thought me leaving the house was big enough to, like, you know, all this came from you leaving the house? I'm like, all of it, Grandma, came from me leaving the house.
Like I said, we're going to talk about politics and the intersection of politics and culture in a second. But I just, again, let me ask you this question about just, you know, I find it interesting, you know, the America's obviously changing a lot,
yes.
Right? And one of the reasons that we have the politics we have now is because of is the demographic changes, America becoming a more non-white place. Eventually, we're going to be a majority-minority place. And so you have empowerment of those communities. You also have backlash among a lot of white citizens and voters who are kind of scared of the demographic change that's happening. It's interesting to me that that the Hispanic community, though a much bigger part of the American fabric than the African American community is. You know, there are many places where the percentage of Hispanics is much larger than the percentage of African Americans. You still see a much bigger representation in our mass culture, of African Americans. So why do you think that is?
You know, I'm going to tell you that there's a sense of, I don't even want to say entitlement, but there's a sense of that some people think they're better than other people. And if all people are created equal, that was from a long time ago. Now we have people who think that they're better than other people. I went to a guy's house who is very well off. And the person comes, he says, come over to the house for breakfast. Well, he didn't make the breakfast. He didn't make the coffee. He didn't bring the food over. Somebody else brought it over, a Latina from El Salvador. And he says to me, while she's standing there, she works hard. She's been with us for a long time. She's trustworthy. She takes pride in her job. And I was almost like, you know what, motherfucker? That's what everybody's supposed to be like. Not just somebody who comes from El Salvador. Everybody's supposed to have that. You're supposed to be take pride in your work and take, you know, and have respect for the people that you work with. So it's a little bit, I would say, a sense of people think that they're better than other people. I particularly don't think I'm better than anybody else. So, because I've seen both sides, and I'm not really particularly crazy about either side, so I'm going to stay where I am. Yeah. But you know, I've seen situations where people talk about other people as in the less than I am. So that I think that has a lot to do with the job.
Yeah, I mean, I get all that, but it still just sort of it still kind of surprises me. Again, you would think that, like, you know, connect that answer up to the question of why it is that, you know, in the entertainment industry, in comedy, in music, in film, why it is that in many ways, I think, I don't want to be politically correct here, so I'm just going to say it, like, the African Americans are overrepresented in the sense of just as the percentage of the population. There are a lot of famous black people, right?
Right.
And they have been for a long time. What we don't have is we don't have, like, a celebrity culture that's nearly as robust of Hispanic Americans. I mean, you are obviously a sterling example of one standout person, but it's not like there are 50 super successful, super famous Hispanic Americans who've crossed over and who not only Hispanics but also white audiences love. I can think of a lot more African Americans than I can Hispanic Americans. Right. Why do you think that is?
That's an interesting question. I think that when television was created, it was created with a lack of, you know, you'd have Marlon Brando played Mexican, Wallace Beery played Mexican, Eli Wallach played Mexican. Italian people played Native Americans. So there's always been, it's a little bit askew. It's always been a bit askew. But also in the 20 years and maybe 15 years since I wrote my first show, where as a creator, you got to see what went on in the machine, was that through when ER was there and when West Wing was at Warner Brothers and when they were doing movies and they were casting shows, it's the people that put pen to paper who are non-Latinos who create the parts that they see. And they see Latinos as a subculture. They don't see us as equals. You know, I'd go to movies and Basic Instinct. What was it, Basic Instinct with Michael Douglas?
Yep. Yeah.
He went to the door, knocked on the door. The lady answers the door. She doesn't speak English. You see that in a lot of movies because it is, you know, hey, do you want your green card revoked? You know, you tell me where they are right now. I mean, that kind of stuff comes into the writing. So I would say that the people who are the writers and the producers and the people who make the projects always see themselves as the heroes and us as non-heroes. Listen, in movies, white people can fly, they can see, they can breathe underwater, they can turn themselves into rocks, they can come back from the dead, they can see through people, they can read minds. But they can't clean their own house. They can't raise their kids. They can't cook their own food. And they would get lost if you didn't show up for 3 days.
All right, Will, kick in here, man.
Yeah, well, I'm going to kind of kick it back into, kind of move over to Trump a little bit. Because, you know, I remember when he first announced that he was running, he, you know, before he even made the announcement from Trump Tower, he was, I mean, I think most people in political media consider him, I mean, the joke, to be honest. And no one really took it all that seriously. And then he goes out and he says the things that he says in his opening press conference. And it was just like, and the reaction was like, oh, well, this is now someone we don't need to take seriously. If we weren't anyway, if we were going to anyway, this guy's just a moron. Why would he even say these crazy things? He doesn't even know what he's doing. But to me, there's, I think there's two sides of this. Because what happened, of course, is immediately his numbers went up. And, yeah. And there was a number of people in the country that were listening to him and taking that seriously, which I have to say shocked me, and I think shocked a lot of people in the political media. And so there's two ways to look at Trump in that way. On one hand, there's this guy that I think people think that has like a lot of deep-seated issues. But there's also a guy that, frankly, just wants to be popular and wants people to he'll say whatever he wants that will get him the reaction that he wants and gets him the attention that he wants. For him to come out and say that and get that response, that feels like it is an indictment not just of Trump, but in fact, all of us. The fact that that was a message, one of the first messages he got was, we're going to build this wall and there are Mexicans that are rapists and we have to do something about this. And that was his opening gambit to the fact that it worked. It seemed a surprise to me, but I'm going to suspect it was not a surprise to you.
Well, you know, I'd never heard it in terms of in politics at that high level, a guy announcing to run for president. But also, you know, I truly believe that he is the guy who tweets out everything that he writes. He doesn't, Mitt Romney, they said that 20 people look at his tweets before he sent it out. This dude, like somebody may have said, you can't say that. And I would respect anybody, especially a comedian or anybody that speaks freely. So part of me is, yeah, I don't agree with what he said, but you've never really seen that approach to politics. And to turn that over and see the people that were motivated and moved by it, and it got violent in places where you knew that that's been the deep-seated feelings ever since. I think diversity is good for some people, but then it's frightened some people. You know, and I don't think that can we all become one and get along? No, I don't think so. If you go to the zoo, the animals are all separated because if you let them all live together, they'll kill each other. So in our population, those places exist. I'm looking over a country club right now that I know that isn't catered to African-American, Latinos, or people who are Jewish, that golf course right there. So those pockets are not even pockets. They're full-on bags. They're full-on places where now, you know, Pensacola, Florida, and Jacksonville, and Arizona, and Sheriff Joe, and parts of California, and parts of Nevada, and parts of Texas, where, you know, clearly the facade of harmony or tranquility has been removed, and this is a kind of down and dirty, gloves off, race to November 8th to see who, when the dust settles, who's still standing. I'm not even sure this far out who is going to be standing. I thought for sure that all of those things and all of the things that were said and all of the things that have come on both sides would implode one or the other. It hasn't done either. So these are probably, I'm going to spend a few of the 5 days in Vegas, but it will be like no other days I've spent in Vegas. I don't think that I will just spend them carefree at the tables. I'm going to think I'm going to have politics all in my side view mirror at all times.
You mean the 5 days between now and Election Day?
Yeah. 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 Between now and Election Days, I'm going to spend three of them in Las Vegas. I'm sure I'll be saying to people, remember to get out and vote, because I have never been somebody to tell somebody how to think. I would just prefer that I remind you to vote, and you do because you feel like it's important.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking is, as someone that's had to navigate this and has had to deal with and a lot of things that you've already talked about with us earlier about the casting and the idea that what are your papers, like, and the fact that we're going to send you back, all the screenwriters kind of having that as a plot point in their movies. You've had to navigate this and deal with this in Hollywood and popular culture for a long time. So, like, you clearly, when you talk about this, you're clearly no shrinking violet. None of this, it seems like a major surprise to you. But it does seem, when you talk about this, that this actually, like, it's a surprise to me to realize just how, frankly, racist and xenophobic a lot of the country is. I feel like it, but I feel like that's just kind of my privilege. Like, I just thought everyone was good. It turns out not everyone is good. But it seems like it's even, do you feel more worried about the America that you live in, learning what we've learned about America with the rise of Trump?
Yeah, I'm going to say absolutely. I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say absolutely yes, because if you don't have respect even of your neighbor, you know, I have a guy that I moved into this house and I trimmed trees that were in my yard, and this guy came over to me and said he had a problem with me. He first started the conversation by saying, "I'm a little disappointed in you," and I would say, "Oh yeah, well, why is that?" And then we had it out over trees that were in my yard, and I cut the trees, and you know, I said, "Listen, man, I didn't buy this house to ask your permission whether I could cut trees." So that put us in that place. And then I got another guy, an old right to life doctor, who should take his own shot. You know, he lives on the other side. His trees are falling onto my house. That guy's pretending like I'm not even there. Like, he just has trees branches falling on my house. We sent him a letter. He's just pretending like I'm not, like, he sees Lopez. It's like, I'm not even there. He's just going to let these trees fall into my house. So I would think that when you lose respect and you lose perspective, that you've lost a lot more than you've gained.
Wait a minute. Wait a second. I want to drill down on the story here. So these are where do you live right now?
I live in an area of Los Angeles in the hills.
Right. Okay. And I'm going to bet that these are white neighbors.
Yes.
Okay. So you got some white folks on each side of you, right?
Right.
And how old are they?
One guy's in his 80s, the right to life guy's in his 80s. His are the trees that are actually falling on my house.
Right.
And the guy who's in his 60s, who is like, felt himself like the commander of the neighborhood, was the guy that came over and told me, as a man to man, I'm disappointed in you.
Right. So, okay. So you're George Lopez, right?
Yes.
Right. So you're pretty famous, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, rich. Famous, yeah. Successful, right?
Yes,
these guys who live here in LA in the hills, these white guys who live on each side of you, they don't look at you and say, "Hey, that's rich, famous celebrity George Lopez." They look at you and see a brown guy.
Yeah,
that's what the moral of this story is.
You know what? Listen, I didn't say their color particularly, but these guys are trying to put me in my place. So,
that's what that's about. I mean, right? That's
entitlement.
Normal people. Again, you know how this is, right? The reality is that most people are like a little intimidated by celebrities. They're a little bit in awe of celebrities. When you see a celebrity, generic celebrity, it's like, "I want your autograph," or like, "Man, like the celebrity moved in next door. That's great. Wow, we got a celebrity here." This is more, but this is, they don't see you as a celebrity. They just see you as a generic brown guy.
I wouldn't see my neighbor walking up to Steve Carell and saying, "I'm a little disappointed in you." I think he'd say, "You know, I thought,
40-year-old version was great.
It was amazing."
Yeah, right. Okay. So that's what that's about. So just go a little deeper on this, just in a broader sense, deeper and broader, right? I thought that when you finished the 2012 election and you saw how important the Hispanic vote was in 2008 and 2012.
It'd be a good 4 years for us.
Right. Well, and also, you also thought that if you were... the Republicans finished that cycle, and the chairman of the Republican Party did an autopsy on the party. Now, I always thought it was weird that Reince Priebus called it an autopsy, because you do autopsy on dead things. But put that aside. One of the key things was something that was a piece of conventional wisdom that everyone accepted, right? If you looked at just the growth of the Hispanic vote across the country, that no political party could be a national political party and hope to win without kind of getting right with Hispanics. You couldn't just alienate the Hispanics. Just the numbers don't work, right? You can't do that. And they reached that conclusion. It wasn't a hard conclusion to reach. You didn't have to be a genius to get there, right? So the last thing in the world you would have thought after the last two election cycles, that autopsy, the last thing in the world you would have thought was that the Republican Party would flock to 14 million voters who voted for him, flock to a guy who started his campaign by trashing Mexicans and said various incendiary, racist, inflammatory things over the course of the campaign. Like, how it's on some level, I'm not being like liberal and condescending about this. It's baffling on some level, given that most Republicans agreed with the notion that you couldn't continue to alienate Hispanics forever, or the math wouldn't work for you to winning national elections. So, like, what does that say, you know, about?
Well, it also says a lot about the Latino community, because if you're able to stand there and do that and there's nobody that you fear coming after you, then you can stand there and say that they're rapists and they're criminals, and I guess some of them are good people, or I'm going to build a wall, I'm going to get Mexico to pay for it. Because we have no big brother, we have no voice that's going to stand there and call you on it. Ana Navarro is probably it. I mean, it's probably Ana Navarro.
Right.
It's been Ana Navarro. Right. But Jesse Jackson doesn't pack the punch that he did. And I think the Republican Party says, listen, if they don't vote, that benefits us too. So why go after them? If we ignore them, they won't vote. And if they don't vote, that benefits our side.
So you're saying you think on some level that Hispanics have failed to leverage the kind of political muscle they have. They're somewhat, I mean, again, I think I'm just trying to decide, don't correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're saying, yeah, there's a lot of racism out there, but the other problem is that in your community, there hasn't been, they haven't done enough to exercise the political clout that they could have.
I would say that there's divisiveness in our own community. There's different languages. Cuban language is different. People from Spain are different. People from Argentina are different. People from Mexico are different. Puerto Rican people are different. So there's not even the adhesive amongst our own cultures to bring us together. So as fractured as we are as Latinos, it's the perfect time to catch us because we're not united in our own. We can't decide what we want for ourselves because we speak different languages. People eat different foods. They're probably different parts of Latin America. So I think we have to look at each other not as a group, but as individuals, and vote as individuals and work as individuals, because this group thing isn't working out for us. I don't think of myself as a group person. I think of myself as a man who's trying to do better for my own family. So instead of wrapping ourselves in whatever flag we want to wrap ourselves in, I think we're doing more damage like that because we keep waiting for a cavalry that's not going to show up, that we need to now say, this guy's teeing off on us. I'm not voting for him. I'm voting, and I'm not voting for him. And I'm going to vote for things that are going to improve my life, somebody who I think is going to make my life better, my family life better, and the future of my family life better, instead of saying, where's everybody else at? We got to stop thinking like that.
Is there a notion that Trump, in this may be a strange way to think about it, but Trump could be a positive in like a catalyzing event in the idea that like this could be the thing that less Latino and Hispanics understand the power that they have. If they can all, like if anyone's going to coalesce them all about one thing, it would be Trump.
I hope it doesn't take a guy calling people criminals and rapists to finally activate to make the red phone flash.
But
aside from that, these people, listen, people work hard. And some people work harder and earlier than everybody else. And I just think that for the people who are here, who have a voice, we have a lot of people who are undocumented here who do jobs that I would say the hardworking Americans don't want to do, but they benefit from those jobs. Everything that in the crops and in the fields and things like that, that are jobs that are backbreaking, that are maybe the toughest jobs that we have, that other people don't want to do, hardworking Americans, that there has to be a variable to allow people who want to work in those fields and in those industries where nobody else wants to work. And when they leave, the crops suffer, the town suffers, the farmers suffer. There has to be a way to unite that group of people with an immigration policy that doesn't involve a deportation force knocking on your door. You know, I'm afraid of a deport. I'm an American citizen, but I'm afraid of the idea of a red van going through the neighborhoods looking for people. I don't know what color the van would be, but this isn't America. I mean, that's not an American way. It's not a policy.
They'd be vans that would be disguised as taco trucks.
You know, they would be all of a sudden a six pack of Corona in your driveway. Why is there a six pack of Corona in my driveway? And then a net goes over you and you just get picked up and taken into like a tow truck. Listen, man, politics has never been a something that you really wanted to follow, like you followed the Lakers or you followed the Cubs or you followed your favorite baseball team. Unfortunately, the last 2 years, people who care about this country have had to follow politics closer than I think they normally would like to.
Yeah.
Do you like it? Do you like being involved? This kind of forward facing?
No, I don't. Not like this, because the things that you have to say are very negative. You know, I say very negative things about Donald Trump. I say very negative things about his family. Say negative things about his wife. And you know, I didn't want it to end up like that. Unfortunately, it has to, because of you're speaking out for more on stage. So unfortunately, it had to take an ugly tone that I would not have wanted to spend the last 2 years doing.
Do you think, like, that actually brings us to how we should end this thing? Just ask this question. You know, I remember when Barack Obama got elected. You had something to do with that. You helped him out getting elected. You know, comedians all over the place were like, oh, shit, like, we got Obama in. That's great. Happy is the president, but he's going to be a real tough challenge for comedy. You know, he's an intellectual. He's a little bit he's a little dry. Yep. This guy's not going to make for – I mean, George W. Bush was a comedian's great dream, yep, right?
Bill Clinton,
comedian's dream. Barack Obama was like, this is going to be tough. And it was. Comedians kind of struggled to get their arms around Obama for a large period of time. They found things eventually that were kind of funny, but not a lot. He's not like a laugh. He's not like a laugh machine, you know, he's not like fodder for jokes. So in a week, we're going to have either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, right? And I know you don't want Donald Trump to be president, but and I know that you won't say, well, I'd be great to have Trump as president because at least we'd have good material. But if he were president, right? What do you think it would do?
I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I think it would raise, well, who knows? Listen, I might end up being chased down the streets of my neighborhood with guys with torches, you know, like Frankenstein. So I would say that the build that wall chance, the locker up chance, I would lose material in order to not elect
Trump
as president.
Right. You'd rather have not have Trump president than have the material that he would provide.
I would rather not have him as president and search in other places for material.
It's one thing to have an objectionable candidate who you mock and make fun of, right? Which you do.
Right.
When that person becomes president, it becomes a little different, right? If Donald Trump became president of the United States, do you think that, you know, the tone of your comedy, the threat that he would represent in your mind, would you become a more, you're not like a political comedian by trade.
No.
You're not Lenny Bruce,
no,
right?
No, not really, no.
Right? So, like, would you become, do you think if someone who you thought was an outright, was outright hostile to Hispanics and was genuinely a danger to the progress that Hispanics have made in this country, if that guy became president of the United States, do you think your comedy would become more political, or would you just sort of keep mocking him the way you mock him now?
Well, also you have to forget that I think that the audience would attack you back. So you would have a place where now you'd have an audience that listens. If he does get elected, now you're going to have his followers say, well, he's the president of the United States. Don't talk about them that way. And in places where it used to be great to work, I'm sure you would have more hecklers, more antagonists. It wouldn't be as serene as a comedy. Not that the world of comedy is serene, but now you'd have people stand up, and I don't think you would have a show particularly as much as you'd have shouting matches.
Right.
So I think it changes the climate. Because who are we as comedians to mock a guy who's been elected by the people of the United States? The office does carry amount of respect. You're leader of the free world. So their followers would almost be like, you know, how dare you? He won fair and square. And how dare you spend your time on stage where I paid to see you talking about something that I would prefer not to have paid money to listen to. So I think it destroys everything. It's a house of cards.
If you might be forced to become a more political comedian, and in the process become a much more controversial figure. It would make your job potentially a lot less pleasant.
Or for people who didn't want to do that, like Amy Schumer had a couple hundred people walk out on something that was, I thought, innocuous. But what happens if now it's official? You're gonna have a huge part of America that is going to be able to speak up louder and be entitled and tell people to go back to where they came from and tell people to, when we're building that wall, and question your ethnicity and question your citizenship, where, you know, we've never really had that.
I'm going to leave it here. The truth is that I know you're hoping that Donald Trump doesn't get elected on Tuesday. And if he doesn't, that means Hillary Clinton will be president and Tim Kaine will be the vice president. So at least, at a minimum, you'll be able to mock Tim Kaine's Spanish.
Yes.
for the next 4 years.
We would listen, Tim Kaine. If that passes the Spanish, that's pretty bad. It's almost like if you're speaking to someone who is maybe hearing impaired, and you speak louder. it comes down to that. You speak slower. I was wondering, you know. It's demeaning in any way.
It's perfectly well-suited Spanish if what you're doing is going to Taco Bell and ordering an enchirito.
So if you want to show off
to your
friends.
Do you remember the enchirito?
It was the enchirito. It was a burrito. It swam in red sauce.
Yeah, the enchirito. Man, the enchirito, one of the most grotesque things, even worse than Trump's Taco Bowl. All right, George Lopez, you are the greatest for
this
coming
great
in.
Great running into you at the game. I mean, all of this because we sat next to each other at a baseball game.
Yeah, you know, baseball is that's one of the things that baseball does. Unlike politics, which sometimes divides us, baseball does nothing but bring us together. I'm John Heilman.
And I'm Will Leach.
And we're both in awe of George Lopez, and we're going to bring this episode of the Culture Caucus to a close. Catch us next week when we can talk about who actually won this fucking dumpster fire shit show.
It's never going to end. Don't fool
it's
the
gonna
listeners.
It's going to end. Come on, Will. It's going to end.
If you want me, I'll be trimming trees in the hills.
All right. See you later, Will.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.